Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
For every other victim out there who has experienced abuse and who has either gone to court or not been able to go to court or not wanted to go to court, I just wasn't going to sit back and allow that to fly. Because of what he had put me through, I have grown up with this whole attitude of I don't care what happens to me. Do you know, I've been hurt enough. I don't care what happens to me. There's nobody can hurt me any more than I already have been. It was always about protecting the rest of my family.
I'm Nicola Tallant. And you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
Amanda Brown's stepfather, Davy Tweed, began sexually abusing her at an early age. For years, she knew the real monster behind the man who presented himself to the public as a star rugby player and a pillar of the community. In 2012, Tweed was jailed for 8 years on charges of child sex abuse, but he got out of prison 4 years early when his conviction was overturned. It wasn't until after his death that his victims were truly able to breathe a sigh of relief. Today I'm speaking to Amanda about her new book, No Peace Until He's Dead, and her years of harrowing abuse at the hands of a paedophile. I'm Niall Donald, and this is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. So, Amanda, I remember the news when David Tweed died. It was up on the Belfast Telegraph and we took it from the Sunday World, and I would have known a bit about the case, but it was straight away, it was amazing that even that it was reported without his history, because although he was a free man at the time of his death, there was no way he was a guy without a stain on his character. But of course, people don't want to always feel like that about people that are heroes. And Davy Tweed was twice a hero, really, wasn't he, in sporting terms and political terms?
Well, yeah, he was. But it's that whole attitude as well of not speaking ill of the dead. Like most people, even somebody who isn't elevated like he was, will have any marks against their character wiped when they die. It's like it never happened, you know, so we can sit all, you know, around their coffin and drink tea and talk nicely about them.
Yeah. But of course, like Davy Tweed was, what he was probably obvious at that stage. And, you know, if I think you've spoken about before how we know for a fact that he sexually abused 8 girls at the very least. And people really weren't under any illusions about him, I think, at the time of his death. And even to get those political tributes, it must have been a blow, really.
It was, but it wasn't that I was thinking about it being a blow to me personally. Yeah. As much as, yes, it did. You know, I did feel aggrieved by some of the things that were being said. But my issue was for every other victim out there who has experienced abuse and who has either gone to court or not been able to go to court or not wanted to go to court for whatever reasons and maybe got a not guilty verdict. And there were these people who were saying, well, sure, he was found innocent in court. Mm. So, you know, that somehow makes him innocent, you know. And it was just, for other victims, every other victim out there, I just wasn't going to sit back and allow that to fly.
No, and because you came forward, it didn't fly. So just to go back, Amanda, like, Davy Tweed came into your life when you were 4 or 5, was it?
Yeah, well, between 3 and 4, so yeah, quite young.
Yeah, and obviously he wasn't your natural father. He became your stepfather, and your mother began a relationship after her marriage broke down. Do you remember your first impressions of Davy Tweed?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't remember them. My mum has said that we seemed to accept him because he would have, you know, got down and engaged with us and, you know, in play, my brother and I, and would have brought us sweets or whatever. So she says that we seemed to really like him. But I guess, you know, it's children. If you're going to be on their level, then they're going to engage with you.
Yeah. Well, you don't question these things as children. Obviously, then your mother married him and they had children together.
Mm-hmm.
But the abuse started happening at a very young age from him.
Yes. The sexual abuse,
yeah.
Yes, it did happen from, like, my first clear memories are from I was about 7 or 8.
Yeah.
You know, there are other memories that are like fragmented that are from before that time, but I can't piece them together, you know, clearly.
Yeah.
And I couldn't piece them together clearly enough for the court case. So I went with that very earliest memory, which was in around 7 or 8.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, Davy Tweed, if people are paedophiles like he was, you know, they're not normal people in the other areas of their life, are they? Like, they have to be, there's something deeply wrong with them. But Davy Tweed was, you know, also a controlling and violent man. Do you have memories of that growing up as well?
Of him being violent?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. No, as much as he wouldn't have, in the very early stages anyway, wouldn't have beaten my mum in front of us, but we were very aware of it happening. We were all terrified of him. Like, I remember being just absolutely terrified of him. And even from a very young age,
yeah.
Trying to gauge what sort of mood he was in before I even settled into play or watching TV or even spoke in the morning, you know, it just...
So you had that kind of hyper awareness of somebody that is so volatile. Like, and that is what a lot of these guys, they do that on purpose, don't they? That is their way of controlling their environment.
Yeah.
You know,
there'll be consequences if you don't behave in the way that I want you to behave.
And of course, he was a monster of a man, wasn't he? He was 6 foot 6,
yep.
And obviously a hugely fit and mm-hmm. and you know, because he was a rugby star,
yeah.
In another way. And what did he have that two personas in the house and outside?
Oh, absolutely,
what,
yeah.
What was his persona kind of outside of the house?
Outside of the house, he was very charismatic. He would have been quite funny, engaging. He would have been quite flirty with other women as well, quite subtly.
Yeah.
You know, he came across as a really lovely man, came across as a family man, you know, came across that he, you know, absolutely doted on his family. That's the way he put himself across externally.
And his rugby career, was it? He obviously played for Ireland 4 times, but he was also kind of a unique person in his rugby career, in the sense that he played at a late age, and also his background. Like, he was a very political man ultimately, so it was kind of uncommon, was it, for it, that the Irish career and then the political background.
I think just the political background itself was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
As much as he might have been politically driven, and he was very involved in the Harryville protests and very involved in a lot of these, you know, the protests that went on.
Yeah.
I guess for him, speaking with the right or wrong people, whoever,
yeah.
Encouraged him to step into politics, but it was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah. But also probably part of guys like him who are narcissistic and controlling.
Well, yeah, this is what I keep saying, is those kinds of people like him, will place themselves in these positions of power.
Yeah.
They'll find an easy route into a position where they demand automatic respect. And, you know, you see them with, you know, teachers or ministers or you know, him with his rugby and his politics. Do you know, it's, I think they all kind of like to create this image of themselves as being pillars of society, you know, and great pillars of community and great men that will fight and advocate for other people.
Yeah, and of course we've seen this again and again, people seek positions of status, like where in sports or TV, we see a lot of it, and films, and that helps them mask what they really are, I think. And
yeah,
that was definitely true of Davy Tweed as well, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, as his political career progressed, you know, how, at that stage, when did you first speak to anybody about what had gone on in your childhood in terms of the abuse that you'd suffered?
Well, the first time I had spoke about it, it was kind of forced out of me.
Yeah.
It was when my brother sat eye to eye with me, as you are now, and asked me the question directly.
And what age were you then, Amanda?
I was 29.
29.
Yeah.
And he'd asked that question, obviously, because it had come to a head in a legal sense, hadn't it? He'd faced charges in 2009, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was because of that court case that my brother was over and had asked me the question then.
Yeah. So when did you first know about this first court case in 2009? Had that?
I knew about that first court case. It would have been a couple of years before the court case actually happened, whenever contact was made.
Yeah.
In relation to the first person that came forward.
Yeah.
Do you know, and I think that's when the guilt started for
yeah.
me, and I was just trying to keep a lid on it because I was frightened of what he would do
yeah.
To my family.
Yeah. And how, like, obviously people listen, of course, to tales of survivors of child sex abuse, and the survivor always speaks about guilt, and people can't understand that, because how could somebody, a child, feel guilty for what was the most horrific act that was done to them when they have no defence? Can you explain why that guilt came upon you?
That guilt came upon me because I was, as my Nexus counsellor explained to me,
yeah.
it was because I was looking at it through the eyes, through the lens of an adult.
Yeah.
So I was reflecting back as that child who wanted to run and tell her mummy, she really did,
yeah.
you know, but she was also afraid of what would happen if she did tell her mummy, you know, given, you know, the way that he had said that.
How had he, like, I mean, how had he, like, because that's deliberately implanted on you, isn't it, as a child? Like, how had he sort of forced your silence, I suppose?
Because he had told me that if I told anybody that he would go to jail, and that my mum would end up begging in the streets with my baby sister, and that my brother and I would end up in homes,
yeah,
in children's homes. And, you know, it was this image of seeing my mum begging in the streets with my baby sister that kept my silence.
Yeah.
You know, I kept my silence to protect them.
Yeah.
You know, if it had been me going off to a home by myself, I because of what he had put me through, I have grown up with this whole attitude of, I don't care what happens to me.
Yeah.
Do you know, I've been hurt enough. I don't care what happens to me. There's nobody can hurt me any more than I already have been. So it was always about protecting
yeah.
the rest of my family.
Which he will have seen in you and mm-hmm. known how to push that button, that you're going to take maybe over responsibility for the people around you. Like, and these guys are, you know, master manipulators, really, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And how, you know, you spoke about your mother there. So your mother had started a relationship with Davy Tweed. I think she was 24, was it? Something like that?
Yeah, in and around that age, yeah, about 23, 24, yeah.
And she'd gone through a marriage breakup at a difficult time in,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
in societal terms. Like, what sort of life did she have with him?
With Davy, my
yeah.
mum had, like, it was, when I reflect back on it now as an adult with understanding,
yeah,
she didn't have a life.
No.
Do you know, she was constantly at his beck and call, and, you know, the house had to be spotless, and she had to have warm food on the table for him when he getting home from work. And, do you know, even us as children, we were just set down what he wanted to eat. It didn't matter if we didn't like it or not, and we had to sit and eat it.
Yeah.
Do you know, and it was, she would have stood and made his peace for him, ironed all his clothes, that, you know, she just, everything was just in servitude to him,
yeah.
you know, her entire life. and anything that was out of place at all resulted in her getting physically assaulted for it.
And she was, of course, brutally physically assaulted over the years. You know, I mean, the you know, beaten black and blue would not be a understatement, would it?
It would be an understatement, beaten black and blue. I can remember one time she was beaten, her face was so bad, like you would hardly recognize her.
Yeah. And while she was pregnant as well, was it?
Oh, she's had through every single one of her pregnancies. She's been.
Yeah. And of course, then, like the police, they had at some occasions come towards these domestic incidents, but nothing ever amounted out of that, did it?
No, nothing did. You know, it was back at a time where the police didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And a woman would not have been supported, even in pressing charges. You know, you're talking about sort of like mid to late 80s, you know, at that time, and then going into the 90s as well, where, you know, my mum would had to, you know, in the 90s where they probably policy slightly changed, but she would had to have pressed charges herself.
And
that's an incredibly difficult thing for a woman to do who's stuck in that situation and is living in fear.
Yeah, because of course she was effectively powerless, wasn't she? Like, I mean, he was an engineer, was he? A train engineer, and presumably he controlled the money, the home, everything about it. And, you know, it is sort of easy to look at it and say, oh, she wasn't as powerless as she thought, maybe. But that's not how it feels, is it, when somebody is repeatedly traumatised?
No, it's do you know what? It's even in the coercive control.
Yeah.
Do you know, so you are, to a degree, powerless because mentally you're just so broken down.
Yeah.
Like my mum did try and get jobs at times as well, and, you know, even go to tech and do courses, and she was laughed at and mocked and ridiculed, and, you know, to a point where she had to leave, you know, jobs. She wasn't allowed to work. She wasn't allowed a life outside of him.
Yeah.
You know, she was powerless, you know, she was 5 foot two and he was 6 foot six, you know.
And a monster.
Yeah.
And would he switch between sort of, would he have a good side and then a bad side, or was it all bad? Because a lot of people, they kind of reinforce, they might say sorry, they might, you know, smooth things over briefly before the rage explosions occurred again.
Well, yeah, to start off with, he would have.
Yeah.
You know, with my mum, he would have apologised and cried and been upset and, you know, I'll never do that again and I'm so sorry that I hurt you. And, you know, I know we hear this a lot, you know, with people like him and, you know, they talk about these cycles that these people go through where, you know, they'll love bomb you and then, you know, something
the
else
intermittent reinforcement where they, you know, and then the nice side, like everybody has a better side and a worse side, but the nice side kind of keeps people there because they always hope it's going to stay.
Yeah. You do. You
know, but it doesn't.
No.
No.
Like people like him don't start off on, you know, a bad foot. He doesn't set off being this kind of monster.
No.
There's a process of grooming.
There's a process of grooming and they're not, they don't make mistakes because it is who they are.
Yeah.
Something warped. So Amanda, you've a brother, is he an older brother?
Older.
And then you have four, half-sisters, I suppose people call it, but it's sisters, isn't it, when you're in, you know, that circumstance. You probably don't think of them like that, do you?
No, I don't. They're my sisters.
No, and that's when you're in those blended families, that's how you think. So what's the age difference then?
So there's 5 years between myself and Lorraine, and then I was 11 when Catherine was born.
Yeah.
And I was 15 when Victoria was born.
Yeah.
And then 19 when Jimmy Lee was born.
Right. So there's a big age gap. Mm. And did he treat them differently than he treated you and your brother?
No.
No.
He didn't.
No.
Some of his family members did.
They
made a distinct difference. You know, when we would have been introduced as Margaret's children and, you know, the other ones would have been Davy's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Davy and Margaret's children or, you know, Davy's kids, but we were introduced separately.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
No.
You know, he didn't make us feel any different.
No. But, and he didn't, you know, were you conscious of being his stepchild rather than his biological child?
I was, in terms of the abuse, because I thought that's why I was being abused. I thought that I was the only one being abused, and I thought it was because he didn't see me as his own daughter.
Yeah.
And this is my, you know, childish mind back then.
Yeah.
You know, and where I was at, thinking about why this was happening to me, and that's the only conclusion that I could draw. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's quite a normal thing, I think, isn't it? To pick on the difference that you feel in yourself and blame it on that. When he first got charged and obviously the word came out, how did you feel then? Did you feel it's all going to come out? Did you feel that would be the end of him as, you know, as a hero, I suppose, or as...
Are you talking about the first court case?
Yeah, the first court case, and maybe the run-up, obviously, there was...
I have to say, remembering back to that time, there was a lot of fear.
Yeah.
A lot of fear of what would happen.
Yeah.
And yes, I had kind of hoped that first case, he would be found guilty and he would go to jail and, you know, that would be the end of it. We could, you know, get on with our lives.
Yeah.
In peace. But that he was acquitted.
Yeah.
At that time. And, you know, the guilt that I held for that, you know, and not speaking up at that time as well. And, you know, I wondered if I had been involved in that court case. But, you know, on reflection, I can look back and think, you know, I can see where the police, you know, played a part in that, that case going how it did.
Yeah.
They didn't do any favours, you know, particularly around the questioning of some of the witnesses.
Yeah.
But...
And at that stage then, was he out of the family home, was he, as soon as that court case? And could you tell us how that kind of came about, how your mother made that final break?
Well, my mum, whenever she first heard about it, it was my mum who rang the police.
Yeah.
So it was reported through to her and she rang the police to report it then.
Yeah.
But social services were then contacted because of, you know, the children in the house.
Yeah.
And they arrived at the house and spoke to her and told her that she had to put him out of the house. And if she didn't put him out of the house, then they would remove the children.
Yeah.
There wasn't any, we'll try and get you to a safe place. They were very well aware of what he was like. My mom had told them, you know, social services, what he was like in terms of the physical violence. And, you know, the police were also aware of it. So she was left with zero support, zero backup. To tell this man who was very volatile to get out of his house.
Yeah. And a lot of women actually can't do that without the support. Your mother did it, which is great credit to her. But some women, even though they know, they just can't face that down. Did he go? He went, though, ultimately, did he?
Oh, yeah, he did. He went.
And was that the end of your mother's dealings with him? Obviously, probably not with the kids. And I know it wasn't with yourself ultimately, but did he, I mean, these guys, they can't stop controlling, can they? Or trying to?
No, it's just, this is how we got to the title of the book, No Peace Until He's Dead. It was because during her divorce, even as well, I just looked at her and I went, we're not going to get peace from him until he's dead.
Yeah.
He was very insidious.
Yeah.
Do you know, and because of how intimidating he could be, you know, he would just show up places and, it was the way he would glare at you. And do you know, even throughout, whenever he was removed from the house and he was allowed supervised contact with my younger sisters, and they expected my mum to facilitate that.
Right.
Initially it happened in a contact centre, but they then expected my mum to facilitate it, and it ended up being facilitated at his sister's house.
Right.
Do you know, so it was just, you know, the kids were being forced to go there. And
what age were they then? Were they?
Oh, I can't remember off the top of my head.
But they were still children.
Yeah,
like they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, did he try different things, anger, and then, you know, these guys, I mean, he had that, held that threat, did he?
It was threat of hurting.
Hurting her.
Us or hurting mum, you know, and that's how I think all of us, you know, have held our silence. It was that fear of our mum being hurt.
And of course, he had all these links into society as well, which means that he's not just a 6'6" ex, you know, prime athlete, but he also had these other people, didn't he, who continued to give him a backing, friends. Like, some of these guys, they get charged, nobody will ever speak to them again. But that didn't happen with him, did it?
No, he still had his loyal supporters, and his family as well supported him.
Yeah.
Do you know, his family all stood by him too.
Yeah. So when, obviously, we spoke about your brother, that was the first time you ever opened up about it. You then went to the police, of course. What was that experience like?
Because of the understanding of how the police messed the first court case up.
Yeah.
I was very reluctant, you know, it was very untrusting. So yeah. It was because I knew that he had friends.
Yeah.
And I can remember whenever we met the police officer and he had mentioned that he played rugby, I was like, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
This isn't going to go in our favour, yep. Is it? And I had said to him, I was like, if I at any point think that you are not acting in my favour on this, I will go to the ombudsman. And he looked at me and he was like, why would you say that?
Yeah.
And I just said, well, you know, because you play rugby, you probably know him, you're probably friends with him, you know, you're probably mates with his brother.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not here for anybody to take the hand out of me. And he was like, well, I'm glad you're not, but you know, I'm not here for that. I'm here for you. And, you know, fair play. If you do feel that, then by all means, go to the ombudsman, and you should.
Yeah.
So.
That built a bit of trust anyway, did it?
A little bit. But, you know, I went into the police station and went through the whole court process with this belief that everybody would be against me.
Yeah.
Because of who he was.
Yeah.
And then again, you know, after his death too, on speaking out about that, I felt that I would have at least half the country against me.
Yeah.
But, you know, there has been an incredible amount of support.
Yeah. Because, of course, you're telling the truth and that comes true, you know. You know, and of course, but that's hard to understand at the time, but the ring of truth, honestly, like, it's as simple as that. Like, if people are telling the truth, people pick it up, you know. But you did have to, nonetheless, go through, was it 4 days on the stand or something like that?
Yeah, well, for every day for the first full week, but it wasn't full days.
Yeah.
You know, it might have been an hour here or there or, you know, I think I had a couple of half days.
Yeah.
And then it was like an hour here and there because they were battling out about the press ban. And then there was the other issue of the bad character.
Yeah.
But every day it was just complete nerve wracking. It was terrible.
Yeah. Now, I obviously wasn't there at the court case, but I can tell you, and I didn't even read many of the court reports, but I can imagine what it was like. So, people go up on the stand, and I've seen it in loads of court cases, and then the barristers, the defending barrister, and that's their job, they start picking. Mm-hmm. You said 1 o'clock, but in your statement it says 20 past one or whatever. Like, it is a brutal, brutal process, isn't it?
Oh, it was awful. I felt like I was being interrogated.
Yeah, which you were, effectively.
Well, but it was like, you know, I didn't feel that even within that system, that it was just unfair because there I was every day for the first week and he spent half a day at most. Do you know, and I just got really frustrated, you know, about that whole, you know, the whole process. But it was awful.
Awful.
It was really, it was terrible to have somebody like closer to what you are to me right now.
Yeah.
Eyeballing me.
Yeah.
And practically calling me a liar when I was standing there speaking my truth.
Yeah.
And I remember the point in time, it was just like the penny dropped with his barrister when he realized that I was telling the truth.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable, you know, just to see that and see the complete change in his tone and demeanor and even facial expressions towards me.
Yeah.
It was...
Yeah, I mean, it's brutal. It really is. And of course, people are being asked about memories and childhood memories that are traumatic childhood memories. Like, that alone is really, really tough, let alone it being interrogated, as you said.
Yeah, you know, you are very vulnerable. You're rehashing some of the worst things that has ever happened to you in your life. And you're not even at a point of healing.
No.
Do you know, everything just still feels so raw.
Yeah.
And, you know, not only is it that, but you've got your abuser in the room with you, eyeballing you, and you can feel their eyes boring into the side of your head.
Yeah.
Do you know, when you're aware of the press behind you, you've got the jury in front of you, and then whoever else happens to fancy to come in and sit down and watch what's going on. Do you know, it was an awful experience.
However, like at the end, then they're, you know, I don't know if people feel, you know, relief or vindication, but certainly your evidence convicted him and he got a healthy sentence. I mean, he got, was it 8 years or 4 years suspended at the time?
Yeah.
How did that feel like?
That didn't feel like justice at all, considering the impact of the abuse on both myself and my sisters, on top of the period of time that it happened over. You know, the sentence in itself didn't feel fair or just. But for me, within that case, the point in time that I felt that I won was the point in time that I could see that his barrister believed me.
Right.
Do you know, that at that point, it didn't. The rest of that court case didn't matter to me. When I realised that I was believed, that's all that mattered to me.
Which is interesting, really, isn't it? That's why people, you know, and we, you know, Sunday World isn't perfect, but we try and give a voice to victims. And, you know, I'm not saying we're perfect all the time, but, you know, that is what victims need, isn't it, really? Mm-hmm. To, you know, that sense of being believed and being heard, like.
Yeah.
When did you become... Did it become apparent that the abuse had also occurred to your sisters? When did you first hear that? Or
it was after within days of me going to the police.
Yeah.
Initially.
Yeah.
Lorraine had spoken up then.
Yeah.
And she wanted to go to the police as well.
Yeah.
And as much as the big sister in me really wanted to protect her and say, no, this is going to be awful.
Yeah.
I also needed her, you know, to do what she needed to do for her own healing.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, we supported each other through that.
Yeah.
So we did.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, you hear cases where the family divides over it. I mean, that just hasn't happened with you, your sisters and your mum. But it must be really hard when it does happen.
Yeah. I have to say, even whenever I was going to the police, because even at that point, whenever I was speaking to the police, I didn't think that my younger sisters, you know, had been...
subjected to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So even at that, and I knew that this was going to cause them some kind of upset or hurt, but it was something that I felt that I needed to do because of the other people that I was aware of.
Yeah.
And it was a case of I need to do what I can do to stop him from hurting anybody else.
Yeah.
And like, as I say, I never thought that he would put his hands on his own children, but here we are.
Yeah. I mean, a monster is a monster, really, isn't he? And that is what he was, whatever way you look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, a man with almost no redeeming qualities, except for chasing after an oval-shaped ball or whatever, you know what I mean? Which isn't a lot. So obviously then he was convicted, but was it 2016?
Mm-hmm.
He was almost at the point of finishing a sentence, was he?
Yeah, he was a couple of weeks off it.
And the appeal came true.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what happened was, and probably in sort of layman's language, it was basically a legal technicality that some of the evidence about his character should, you know, the appeal judges at least believed that shouldn't have been presented. And in the manner it was. And so he was found, the conviction was overturned. Never at any point were the facts of the case found to be incorrect, if you know what I mean. So they're very different things. You can sometimes, there's appeals and the judges can say that, you know, the facts are wrong and it should be thrown out. But this is a kind of a technicality, I suppose. How did that impact you like at the time?
Yeah, at the time there were rumours going around that it was because there was extra evidence that would then prove that he was not guilty, but that was not the case.
No.
And it wasn't how the judge directed the jury on how to use the bad character reference, which his legal team brought in.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a technicality that he got off on. I was shocked.
Yeah.
you know, I wasn't aware that he had even put in an appeal.
Yeah.
I didn't know that appeal was being heard. I was confused as to why it was happening 4 years later.
Yeah.
Like 2 weeks off his release date.
Yeah.
Like we were preparing for him to get out of jail.
Yeah.
So we were, but we were preparing for him to get out of jail with 4 years on license.
Yeah.
Thinking that that would give us some level of safety.
Yeah.
So when he was getting out of jail, as if this court case never happened, it was that fear then that he would send somebody after us.
Yeah.
Or come after us himself.
Yeah. And did you see him again after he got out?
I didn't, but you know, the rest of them did. I lived in Belfast, so I wasn't there, but they lived in Ballymoney and they would have bumped into him at the supermarket or at the doctor's surgery, you know, just in passing, whatever.
Yeah, in a relatively small town.
Yeah.
And how was he with them when they came across him? Did he stay away? Did he speak?
Oh, he didn't try to speak to them, no, but he would have, you know, glared at them.
Yeah.
He would have tried to intimidate them.
And how was he treated in the community at that point? Was he treated as a...
I can't answer that. I
no.
don't know because I wasn't there. But, you know, I would have expected that for him to be walking around as large as life as he was, that, you know, there would have been people there. He had his drinking buddies as well in town, so...
And they stuck with him. So when he died, of course, which is No Peace Until He's Dead, is the name of the book you've written. When was it? Was it 2022? Sorry, was
21.
It? 21.
October 21, yeah.
He obviously, David Tweed died as a result of a motorbike accident.
Mm-hmm.
He you know, he was in a crash and passed away. How did you get that news and how did it impact you then?
It was a Thursday and my phone had died and I just let it. Normally, when my phone's about to die, I'm normally plugging it in, you know, because I'm afraid of missing something.
Yeah.
But I had just left it that evening. I was just like, oh, it's fine. I'll just plug it in and we'll get it in the morning. So in the morning, I lifted my phone and I seen these missed calls and a message from my brother. And I was like, can you ring me as soon as you get this? And I was like, oh, somebody's died.
Yeah.
Do you know, when I rang him, I was like, oh, who's died?
And did you think it could be...
No, I didn't for a second.
Yeah.
You know, I was joking with him, you know, because my brother doesn't ring very often,
no.
You know, we don't really speak to each other frequently,
you know,
unless something has happened or either of us, usually whenever I need him to do something in the house for me. but, you know, it was just that whole, oh, who's died, you know, joking.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, Davey. And I was like, Davey who? And he was like, Davey Tweed. And I went, are you sure? And he goes, yeah. And I went, oh, no, but are you really sure? Is it absolutely him? And he was like, yeah, definitely. I've got it in good authority. And I was like, okay. And I just went, I'll believe it when I see it. And I was like, do the rest of them know? And he was like, yeah, I was speaking to them last night. So I rang them to see sort of like how they were about it. But I still wasn't prepared to believe it until I seen it in black and white.
Yeah.
And then whenever I seen it first break, I think it was Belfast Telegraph broke it on social media.
Yeah.
Was the first that I had actually seen it in black and white. And that's whenever I shared, you know, my version.
Yeah.
And then spoke to my sisters again because it's like, it is real.
Yeah.
You know, how do you feel now?
And how did they feel like? Because he's still their father. Was there any of that conflicting or at that?
Well, you see, I was aware, I was worried that they would try and hide any sadness through fear of it upsetting me, given that they knew, you know, exactly what I had been through. You know, and I just wasn't sure how they would feel, you know, about it, in spite of knowing that he, you know, by this stage I knew that he had abused them as well. Do you know, I still was in that headspace of, but that's their dad and I don't know how they're going to feel about that. And I wanted to make sure that their feelings were honoured.
Yeah.
Do you know, I wasn't out celebrating because he didn't, by the time he died, he just didn't matter to me. Do you know, I got to a point of indifference.
Yeah.
So there was no celebration for me. I didn't care.
Yeah.
I was just concerned about how they would feel about it. And I wanted to make sure that they were honouring their own feelings, regardless of how they thought I would feel.
And of course, because I mean, that's one of the great confusing things when you have a man, a father that, you know, should trust absolutely unconditionally and implicitly. for somebody to abuse, to be an abuser then, but it gives rise to contradictory feelings because he's still a father and a father figure, of course, for you, I suppose. Mm. Obviously, Amanda, you've, like we spoke about all over those, all those years, like you can, at this point, you can tell that you've gone through a whole, as well as the legal journey and the factual journey we've gone through, you've gone through a whole other journey, obviously, in a, on a psychological level, have you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, how could you, I know that that's even harder to describe than when something happened or whatever, but how, like what sort of realizations have you come to and how has that been achieved, I suppose?
A lot of counseling.
Yeah.
But I sort of poured myself into like holistic therapies as well, because I found that to help too. Counseling was good.
Yeah.
But you know, it was just tapping into the deeper issues. So, you know, I got involved in like Reiki and reflexology and massage and things like that, you know, because all of those things help with anxiety. And, it was through some of those and sort of like, I guess whenever you allow yourself to slow down in those situations, that you allow yourself to think about things maybe in a more clearer way. But I think one of the biggest realizations for me was that point in time that I realized that I should not be holding the guilt for everything that he has done on everybody else. And that would have been the first time that I felt any anger or hate towards him for what he did.
Yeah.
I hated him for what he did to my family.
Yeah.
I hated him for how much he hurt my mom, for how much he hurt all my sisters and those other girls as well. But I never ever felt hate or anger for myself up until that point that I realized that, hang on a wee second, I was only a child.
Yeah.
Do you know, and I think that came from my son.
Yeah.
And looking at him and thinking, I could never blame him for somebody else hurting him. So why would I blame myself at that age for the same thing?
Do you know? No, absolutely. And I mean, having kids, you do see, like you can't even blame them for things they do themselves, let alone what's done to them, you know? Have you know, you spoke, I mean, you battled with your mental health at very, very much at different times, you know. At what stage did that really come upon you, like that struggle with mental health?
I think I've always struggled with my mental health, you know, battling the whole keeping it in.
Yeah.
And as well as that, presenting myself as a different kind of a person, you know, because as much as he had his two different personas, so did I.
Yeah.
You know, in the house, I was a little injured child.
Yeah.
Outside of the house, I was ballsy and assertive and, you know, wouldn't have let anybody speak to me or look at me in the wrong way.
Yeah.
So I had this persona as well, and it was challenging keeping that up. And you know, that impacted my mental health along the way too. But the guilt really, really impacted me. I massively struggled with the whole guilt of other people being hurt.
Yeah.
And that thought that as a child, if I had have ran to my mum, that these other people wouldn't have been hurt. And, you know, these are people that they were my sisters.
Yeah.
Do you know, when there were other, you know, there was another close family member as well. And, you know, then there was these other people too. And it was like, if I had have spoken, they wouldn't have been hurt.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been able to do that to them.
Yeah.
So it was the guilt of that really, really pulled me into a very, very dark place.
Yeah. Because that's how, you know, that's, you know, he implanted that in you as well, didn't he? Like he knew to trigger that guilt reflex, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a horrible thing to do even in itself, you know, to do to a child where you're putting all that stuff on a, like, I know the abuse is the terror and the horror, but even putting that psychological trauma on a child, like, is so wrong, you know? I mean, has the writing of the book and all the interviews and people asking you questions, how has that been like?
The writing of the book has been very cathartic.
Yeah.
To be able to take all the pain that yeah. I was holding on to and put it out in paper. Like, I actually did take a copy of it and burn it, not a printed copy, but you know, one of my first drafts. Yeah. I took it and burnt it.
Yeah.
And it was, for me, very, very cathartic. It was really good to get all of that out and just to burn it, to send it on its way. And speaking to other people, it's that, again, that sort of like big sister in me, that want to protect other people. Do you know, that's something that was always in me, that little person. I was always speaking for the underdog. I was always advocating for everybody else.
Yeah.
And yes, he leaned in on that, and that's what he used against me.
Yeah.
But that's where I'm at again.
Yeah.
I am back there, and I am that person that will continue to advocate for victims.
Yeah. And people need, like, it's you know, it's one thing to have an expert speak about childhood abuse or whatever, but to have a survivor, it hits differently. I'd say you've had lots of people, you know, contact you on social media or whatever, and like it hits them, doesn't it?
Yeah, I have had quite a few people who have messaged me personally.
Yeah.
Who have experienced similar, and you know, they've just said that I've got so much out of your story, and some people are quite thankful for it. Other people have maybe asked for help because they don't know where to go or you know, what they need to do. Because it's like within the book, what I hope is that people will recognize themselves in the various stages of that. But by the time they get to the book, I hope that they were able to see that there is a path through.
Yeah.
That, and their path is their path to walk. I'm not here to tell anybody how they should or shouldn't heal or what they should or shouldn't do, but just to give somebody that bit of hope.
So Amanda, like, you know, the book is out and it's doing well. And how are the family? Like, your mum spoke to the Sunday World, of course, this weekend. And your sisters have been in the paper as well. How are they? Are they recovering? Are they feeling strong and supported?
Yeah. Do you know what? We're all at different stages of our healing journey, but we all support each other.
Yeah.
Do you know, I have bad days and they'll swoop in and keep me up. And, you know, there's other days whenever, you know, one of the rest of them will be struggling and the rest of us will swoop in and try and hold them up. But like, you know, we're typical sisters, you know, we will bicker and fight amongst each other. But when it comes to the hard stuff, we're all there for each other.
Yeah. And that's been really obvious. And it's a great gift to each other.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much, Amanda. And I hope you're nearly done with your rounds of interviews, are you?
Hopefully, yeah.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Chloe Domini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.